Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity, who is off to the NRA convention, which we mentioned yesterday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, no, we have bad, bad and crazy martinis. No good ones came to the surface today, so we're going to go with bad, bad, and crazy martinis, and they definitely qualify for those descriptions today. We also want to let you know that we're sponsored by SimpliSafe Home Security. Go to simplisafe.com/ricochet right now to get 10% off your home security system. Let's start with the breaking news, Ian, and who knows how much this could change by the time some folks hear this. But after much back and forth between UC Berkeley and Ann Coulter, it appears that the Ann Coulter speech will not happen. Of course, at first she was invited by the College Republicans, also Young Americans for Freedom. She accepted. The college said it could not guarantee her security, so they canceled it. Firestorm of protests. They offered her a chance to give the speech, but at a far less favorable location. She declined. Then it was going to be a public speech. Then she sued, and all sorts of things going back and forth. But now it appears Ann Coulter is canceling her appearance at UC Berkeley, Young Americans for Freedom, withdrawing the invitation. And once again, it all boils down to security, which neither the college or apparently the town of Berkeley is willing to provide for this. So, Ian, while a lot of conservatives might not necessarily want to make Ann Coulter the poster child for free speech that they'd like to make their stand on here, it's important to make the stand where it needs to be made, and it looks like everybody loses here.
Exactly. So let's say the first thing, which is just a common sense safety point. So basically, as you outlined, Greg, the university basically refused to protect her. And then apparently, although the city is now denying this, Berkeley police, when it comes to the type of clashes and or thuggery that we've seen in recent months, the police are basically under a stand down order. And according to documents that were revealed, the police are not supposed to intervene unless they think that someone's life is in imminent danger, which is an extraordinary, extraordinary abuse by neglect of law enforcement power. But what that meant, in addition, what that meant combined with the fact that YAF had has said this morning that it was just too dangerous for them to encourage people to go, meant that I think the only responsible thing in terms of just pure physical safety was for Ann to cancel the speech. She won't be responsible for the clashes that may still break out. She won't have encouraged people to come. These things are just unknowable, and so she needs to be concerned about her own safety as well. There's no telling, what somebody might be willing to do. All of that said, what this means now is that, at least in Berkeley or potentially like-minded places, Antifa and the mob get to decide who speaks and who doesn't. This was a sort of loose coordination between the university administration, left-wing activists, and the city to ensure that someone could not exercise their First Amendment rights at a public university. What that means going forward is that others are likely to try the same thing. It means that I would suspect that it means that this is basically the end of the free speech era, such as it has ever been at Berkeley, and probably at a number of other campuses which will follow up these tactics. And it's a victory for which left-wing that's going to cause left-wing activists to smell blood in the water. That's going to make the fight for free speech much more difficult, I think, all across the country, especially on college campuses. The central fact of the free speech movement, which ironically began at Berkeley, which continues today, but now pushed by us on the right, is that you can say under the United States Constitution vile things. You can say much, much worse things than Ann Coulter was going to say at Berkeley, and worse things than she has ever said. And the United States Constitution protects you from threats to your physical safety because of that speech, or threats that the government would clamp down on that speech. And as of now, at Berkeley, that's simply no longer true.
Further evidence they can't win the argument because they won't allow the argument to take place. And the stand-down order is chilling, Ian, because it reminds me of Baltimore, the stand-down order and the mayor ordering police to give people freedom to destroy, which may or may not have happened if Coulter had given the speech. But for her safety and the safety of those who would actually want to listen, who knows what would have happened. So
a much more alarming safe space.
Yes, exactly. All right. Speaking of the left coast, let's go to our second bad martini. This is from NBC News. This broke late Tuesday afternoon Eastern time. A federal judge Tuesday blunted the impact of one of President Donald Trump's executive orders on immigration, forbidding the White House from withholding federal funds from sanctuary cities, local governments that limit police cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Federal District Court Judge William Orrick issued a nationwide injunction in response to a lawsuit filed by San Francisco and nearby Santa Clara County. They argued that the president's January 25th executive order declaring sanctuary cities ineligible to receive federal grants was unconstitutional. Quote, "The Constitution vests the spending power in Congress, not the president," the judge said. "President Trump's executive order cannot constitutionally place new conditions on federal funds." The Trump administration argued that the lawsuit was premature because the government hasn't yet taken steps to carry out the executive order. So, Ian, the appropriations process obviously is approved by Congress, but as we all know, there's a lot of discretion inside government departments about how they can use that money. We've seen it in presidents of both parties for a long time now. And so Jeff Sessions had talked about grants coming from the Justice Department being reduced or eliminated in some cases due to local officials refusing to cooperate with federal immigration law. And so now we've got a liberal judge saying not only can local officials refuse to obey the law, but you can't take away their federal funding as a result of it. So the liberals get to have their cake and eat it, too.
Every Trump case that we've seen so far has basically been judge shopped. You know, they're looking for forums in which they'll find sympathetic folks on the bench that will give them the result that they want, which is, you know, another reason that we're on the West Coast for this, like we were on the West Coast for the travel ban decisions. There's also, you know, significant question about Judge Orrick's political loyalties, an Obama appointee, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Set all of that aside, I think there are two key takeaways here. One is basically the court invoked once again its completely made up standing standard for all cases involving Donald Trump, which is basically anybody can bring a case. You don't have to prove standing because it's Donald Trump we're talking about, and so the normal rules go out the window. And so the jurisdictions that are actually part of this lawsuit, or that brought the lawsuit, San Francisco among them, don't currently have any standing because no one has actually enforced this rule. So no one has been affected by it. It's not even clear who, it's not 100% clear who's potentially affected by it, because the DOJ would have significant discretion in what the executive order allows. But the court still allowed the case to go ahead. So again, this is one more example of courts bending the rules at the very beginning to make these cases possible. In the actual content of the decision, I think this is really just bizarre showboating. As David French notes on The Corner, and Andy McCarthy also is writing about this for National Review, the order itself says that the DOJ can withhold these funds as provided by law, you know, or within the bounds of the law as it exists. So DOJ was not making any claims to be withholding or doing anything with federal funds that would not be allowed by the law. It was simply saying within the borders already set by Congress. Here's what we're going to do. And so what the court effectively did is it came along and said, you can't do this thing that you never intended to do in the first place. And has basically created a hypothetical situation in which the Department of Justice overstepped the bounds that it said it wasn't going to overstep and slapped them down on those grounds. The problem was that the order was written in sort of a muddy legalese way so that it looked like more was happening than actually happens in the order. But the order really doesn't change anything. It just says, we're going to start enforcing the law like the previous administration refused to do. So this is just another case of, you know, a judge sort of inventing the conditions to slap down the Trump administration. And I'm sure he'll be dining out on it for a long while to come. There are legitimate questions to be raised about this order prudentially and legally. We've talked about this a little bit behind the scenes here at NR, but the grounds on which it was batted down are absurd, and an appeal, I'm sure, is already in the works, and rightly so.
So a body blow to free speech and a body blow to the rule of law. What a fabulous day. But if you happen to live in a locale where you have a sanctuary city because your officials are more concerned about being in the right spot on the far end of the liberal spectrum than they are with actually doing their jobs and enforcing the law, you might want to invest in a little bit of home security because it's obvious that your local officials aren't making that a very high priority. That's where Simply Safe comes in. When you order your Simply Safe home security system online, you're taking the first easy step to protecting your home and family. With entry sensors, motion sensors, and glass break sensors, soon you'll make your home a burglar's worst nightmare, and you'll be done setting it up in under an hour. Look, Simply Safe comes pre-programmed to work right out of the box. Just plug in the base station, and it'll actually talk you through the entire process. Really, even someone like me, who isn't the slightest bit handy, can install it. I am worthless when it comes to these sorts of projects, but this is pretty easy. The entire system is wireless, so there's no need to drill holes in your walls or do other permanent damage. And once you're all set up, Simply Safe makes it just as easy to stay protected month to month. There are no long-term contracts, no hidden fees, and get this, it's just $14.99 a month for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, professional monitoring, and emergency dispatch service. So don't wait another day to take your home safety into your hands. Get Simply Safe. As soon as we're done with this podcast, go to simplysafe.com/ricochet right now to get 10% off your home security system. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com right now, simplysafe.com/ricochet. So, Ian, we've got speech under assault. We've got the rule of law under assault. Oh, and we've got a burgeoning potential nuclear showdown going on in the Far East. It's just a delightful, sunny political and policy day today. But today is also an interesting event in that Donald Trump, the president, is having all 100 senators down to the White House for a in-person briefing on the situation with North Korea. And so there's a lot to consider here. Obviously, what will the U.S. policy be? What's the best diplomatic strategy? How can we engage China and others to finally get North Korea to act like a rational member of the international community? All sorts of really important things you could be discussing right now. At CNN, though, that's not important. At CNN, it's why is Trump making everybody go to the White House? This is kind of a long clip. This is Brooke Baldwin. Brooke Baldwin is, of course, an anchor at CNN. She's not the sharpest tool in the shed. Just last summer, Ian, she was on Washington Celebrity Jeopardy, and she did better than Blitzer, because Blitzer never even made it to Final Jeopardy, which means he was in negative territory. Baldwin made it to positive territory, but then the final question was, with the passing of Justice Scalia, who is now the longest tenured member of the Supreme Court? Of course, it was an answer, so it's not really a question, but the answer, of course, is who is Anthony Kennedy. It's not that horrible that she got it wrong, but it would have been nice if she could have actually picked someone who was on the Supreme Court. She picked David Souter, who was long gone from the Supreme Court, so, and was actually put on the bench after Anthony Kennedy. So all that is pretense. She's talking to Colorado Senator Cory Gardner, and she decides the location of this meeting is really what needs to be scrutinized here and what Donald Trump's really up to with this.
understand there's a perfectly good skiff up there on the Hill, and I can't think of in recent memory any time, you know, 100 U.S. senators, or I don't know how you all are getting there, and buses, you know, SUVs, you're all rolling down Constitution Avenue to head to this makeshift skiff in the old executive office building. Why do you think you're going there?
Well, that's where the meeting is at. I think arguing over where a meeting is going to be on North Korea is about the stupidest thing Washington could be doing. It's almost as silly as putting the Super Bowl in downtown Pyongyang. It's just something we don't need to do. It's ridiculous. Let's fight about the policy on North Korea. Let's argue about the right direction for this country. But having an argument over where a meeting occurs, that's just silly.
But you know, critics are saying, Senator, that this is just part of this big show and this run-up to day 100 for this White House. Are you concerned that you and your colleagues are being used?
I think we're talking about North Korea. We're talking about a regime that has dozens of nuclear weapons, that is testing them, that is violating United Nations sanctions.
But we're also talking politics.
The last thing we ought to be doing is arguing about where the meeting is. That's just stupid. If Washington gets caught in an argument over where a meeting is, no wonder the American people are so pissed off at it.
Cory Gardner, that's why you got elected. Brooke Baldwin, that's why people hate the media and one of the reasons why Donald Trump won. Ian, I'm sure you could have made this point as well. Pro tip, anytime you hear a journalist say your critics say, it's because they couldn't actually dig one up or were too lazy to, and they're conflating their own opinion with the point they want to make in the interview. So, Ian, what do you make of CNN focusing on this arcane detail?
Yeah, it's exactly what she was saying. I'm saying that, you know. Well, I mean, this is just really hilarious, and as you point out, Greg, this is the reason so many people are frustrated with the media. I mean, the obvious point here is you have a senator on the line. Ask them some substantive questions.
Right.
But I think this is symptomatic of another problem in media. Maybe Ms. Baldwin is an exception here, but I don't think that's true, which is that you have a lot of people who really don't have a strong grasp of substantive questions. They don't have sort of an introductory level grasp of policy on major questions when they arise. And so they default, like she did there, to politics, to appearances, to, you know, questions that are considerably smaller and a little more gossipy and easier to get your hands around. I think that that's a huge, huge factor in media coverage right now. I mean, you saw that throughout the campaign season with journalists who were eager to avoid questions of policy and easy to, you know, eager to jump to what are the political consequences of this? You know, what does crucial Waukesha County think of, you know, X? And those are often not the most important questions. And I think that Cory Gardner, with maybe an unusual surprise, was pointing to something like that fact.
No, absolutely. And of course, since they don't have the grasp of policy, they don't really have an idea yet about what Trump's plan is, we got to make it negative about him somehow. And so this is how we're going to do it, by actually inviting everyone in for the conversation. It kind of reminds me, Ian, of when I was a prospective student on my first trip to Hillsdale as a prospective student. And I wanted to be a journalism major. And I was frustrated by the fact that Hillsdale didn't have a journalism major. And the person I talked to said, well, we can teach you how to write. We'd also like you to know something before you actually write about it. Other schools will teach you how to write, but they might not actually teach you what you need to know before you write about something. And that has turned out to be really good advice. So I would recommend heartily everyone in the media to take Ian's advice and Hillsdale's advice. Know what you're talking about before you talk about it. The more you know.
The more you know. Exactly.
Ian, thanks for pinch hitting today. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. And don't forget to visit our friends at Simply Safe Home Security, simplysafe.com/ricochet.